confusing, or is it all confusing?
Anybody have any experience with some of the things that I talked about? Not personal experience necessarily, maybe grandparents or know about. She had something like that after their own trauma. I'm sorry.
When you get into counseling and they tell you, I don't know if it's just an experience, people that tell you just don't go to sleep, is there anything behind that?
That's like, it right there.
Well, I mean, but like, what about, like, on the way to the hospital, like, don't go to sleep? You know what I mean? Would that make any difference?
No. Okay. Going to sleep doesn't make any difference. But what they want to do is check to be sure you can be awake. When they tell kids if they have an injury, we used to have an emergency room of sheep that they all got, the parents all got when they went home, which said wake the kid up every couple of hours. And what it meant was, could you just wake them up? You know, where they, did you have now enough bleeding or enough injury that you could not arouse them? And that's the big thing, that going to sleep wasn't the problem. Okay, well, let's go ahead and pick up where we left off. This is what we were talking about. So we were talking about those two, and I want to be sure that as you have that very clear in your mind, it always asks questions about this already. So a smart person is going to definitely know about subdural and epidural hematomas. They're very common. And now, here's an example of one. And tell me what we have. Let's see what. Well, this is subdural. Never mind. Here's the problem with this one picture, by the way. This picture could also serve the purpose for two, except it's kind of in the wrong area. What they've done is they flipped the dura over so we could see the hemorrhage when they took the picture. So in case of subdural, this is not where it ought to be. This is the dura mater here, but you have to kind of imagine they flipped that over so we could see the blood. Now, one of the problems with a subdural hematoma is that, it can pre-accumulate very slowly, and it may even go ahead and clot. And you've got this clot, which typically is not a big ball of blood, but more of a long, flat kind of thing, kind of like a partially deflated beach ball or something. And it's kind of like a Pop-Tart now. You know, it's got this kind of organized, rigid kind of blood clot on the outside, but as it begins to break down, it develops more liquid, broken-down blood in the inside long about day 3 or 4. And that sort of draws water to itself. So one of the things that might happen is the granddad will have a bleed like this, and then it might be that he really begins to have very strange long about day 5 after an injury, or he won't even have told anybody about it. And what's happening is that it appears as though the clot is beginning to grow and like the bleed is recurring, and it might. But what also can happen is the clot, as it starts to break down internally, will be like kind of a Pop-Tart, you know, with the outside that's sort of crispy. Is there anybody who does not know what a Pop-Tart is? I mean, it's one of the four basic food groups. You know, there's carry-out, frozen food, leftover Pop-Tarts. So those are four. But you got that kind of gooey, gelatinous central area, and that can pull water into itself, and so it will increase in size just because of the water inside the clot, inside that kind of dissolving part of the clot. And so it does appear that all of a sudden he's got symptoms related to depression, and they get worse. And the threat will really not really bleed. Still, the thing has to be removed. Okay. Here is the epidural hematoma, showing that thing, accumulation right there from that broken blood vessel. This right here would be a decidedly unusual spot that can occur down here at the base of the brain. Typically, it's something over here, more along the line you see up here with it, where the middle meningeal comes all the way through. Okay, and that is the one where somebody is rendered unconscious because initially they're hit, and it's that kind of concussion kind of injury first. There's another kind of injury that can occur traumatically, can also occur because of high blood pressure, and this is called a subarachnoid. So we're kind of working our way down through the meninges. We have epidural, which was on top of everything, then we have subdural, that was between the arachnoid and the dura mater, and now we're coming down into the actual space where the cerebral spinal fluid moves around into that subarachnoid space, and between, and then the next stop is the pia mater, and then the next stop is the brain substance. Here we're taking a look at bleeding that occurred into the cerebral spinal fluid, the zone where the cerebral spinal fluid moves around. That can occur traumatically. It can also occur because of a blowout of a blood vessel because of piece here, particularly that Pia Mater, has innervation to it, and those people experience extraordinary pain at that moment. Now, it's commonly due to trauma. It can be due, particularly, again, in deceleration injuries. I would say more often we will see this due to high blood pressure. The other thing about when it occurs in trauma is that the trauma can weaken one of the blood vessels at the base of the brain, but not tear at that moment. And so these people are at risk. When we know about someone who's had a fairly high-speed impact, you say, well, look, the airbag deployed, I didn't really hit my head on the windshield or anything. But even though that you had a very sudden deceleration in the brain and things move, you might have stretched some of those blood vessels. And so we keep close watch on those folks for about a week, because occasionally we may see the bleed come up as late as 5 or 7 days later. And the blood is now in the subarachnoid space. That would be traumatic. It can occur acutely, but it might occur later. And then, but again, of course, in the case of a high blood pressure that causes a rupture or blow out of a blood vessel, it's going to bleed right then. Typically from the circle of Willis is where we see those. This particular case is an example of a gal who didn't lose her cool. I mean, this brain obviously is an autopsy specimen, but I remember this case quite well. I did this autopsy when I was a resident, and the mother who had been driven to choir practice at her church one night, and her daughter, who was just getting her driver's license, she had a learner's permit, and she wanted to drive every chance she got. And so she had driven her mother, and she was going to stay in the car, and she did. She waited out in the car until choir practice was over, and mom comes out of the church. She sits down in the passenger seat, and as they're driving out, mom screams and grabs her head and sort of keels over like this and has a grand mal seizure. And the girl, instead of sort of, blowing her cool, immediately hit the gas and drove to the hospital, drove into basically up to the emergency entrance, ran inside my mother's out of the car at that point, it took her a day or so to actually die, but at that point, the game was over. Probably wasn't anything at all that could have been done, and that is that case, showing the blood all over the convexity here, a lot of clot in this area here, and blood all over, because it flows very quickly in that subarachnoid space. So that's another kind of hemorrhage. So we've kind of moved on in terms of blood that is on the surface, as well as already taking a look at bleeding that occurs within the substance of the brain itself. Well, mentioning vascular issues, vascular blowouts, let's take a look now at kinds of injury that occur because of vascular damage itself. And stroke, of course, as you know, atherosclerosis and myocardial infarction and stroke and so forth are leading causes of death for people in the Western world. We don't die of infectious diseases like everybody else does. In fact, if you take a look around the world to see what is the leading cause of human mortality, it's not any other. It's what we have isn't even in the top 10. I don't think it may not be yet, anyway. The most common cause of death in the world today is probably infantile diarrhea in that first week of life. There's essentially no fluid reserve. Kid gets the squirts, he's going to die. It's essential. The next most frequent cause of death is malaria. Next is tuberculosis. So things that we die with, which are very important, are related to us aging as well as probably our lifestyle and that sort of thing. So when we look at vascular disease involving the central nervous system, we got basically two orders of injury or two orders of problem. One will be hypoxic injury, where we have a clogged, either chronically clogged or acutely clogged vessel, or a vascular blowout, like we talked about here, where there's hemorrhagic thing. And high blood pressure can lead to hemorrhages, as we talked about a moment ago, in the subarachnoid space, as well as hemorrhages within the substance of the brain itself. Well, let's take a look here at different kinds. The TIA, by the way, that is a acronym for transient ischemic attack. We talked about these basic terms right now. Transient ischemic attack, TIA. You know what ischemia means? What is the word ischemia?
Lack of blood flow.
Yeah, lack of blood flow, exactly. It really isn't saying it's hypoxic, but it's indirect hypoxia because ischemia means no blood. Emia is the blood part of this sort of thing. So ischemia means there's decreased blood flow and it's transient. Person will experience tingling or maybe loss of ability to use an extremity, and 5 minutes later it's back. Or they hear the phone ring and they can't get up to answer, or they do and they can't speak. And a few minutes later, they can. By definition, a transient ischemic death, when that occurs, and if there is no residual, no actual underlying death of tissue, there's no residual neurological problem, it is a transient ischemic death. It was ischemic for a short while, the blood flow returned, and typically what it means is we had some sort of maybe platelet aggregations that occurred in a particular region, blood vessels, say due to atherosclerosis, and reduced the blood flow temporarily, and then it washed away, and then blood flow returned before the neurons died. So what we were looking at there was neuronal hypoxia, not neuronal anoxia. In other words, reduced oxygen because of reduced blood flow, leading to neuronal malfunction, but not neuronal death. And then when the blood flow returned within a minute or two, because that's all you got, as you, I'm sure you know, then the neurons recharged themselves and everything began working again. So by definition, if there is any residual effect where the person can no longer use maybe their hand, part of their hand, say part of their fingers or something, it started out as their arm, but part, most of it came back. If there is residual loss, either sensory or motor, well, it's no longer a TIA, it's now considered a stroke. We've actually lost part of neural tissue and it's never coming back. The stroke means literally that. It's an ancient term that's been used for Lord knows how long, and it means that someone just had some catastrophic neural event and they collapsed. Stroke, boom, they were hit. They were struck by something. And again, by definition, if it is ongoing, it means you've lost tissue. We don't use that term stroke to apply to anything that's transient or something that when it goes, all neurological signs have resolved and you're back to work. So the stroke is means we do have infarcted tissue, we have dead tissue, we've lost tissue. And that can occur because of either an embolic event or because of a thrombotic event at that site. Here we're taking a look at some sections. And these are not hemorrhagic, and you might take a look at that and say, I got news for you, Buster. It sure looks like there's blood, old blood, you know, black, blue, brown blood in there. Well, okay, I mean, indeed, there will be a small amount of hemorrhage into these areas, because sometimes what we will see is there's occlusion with a tiny seepage of blood around the occlusion. I guess it's not an occlusion if it's that. Let's say there's a clot or something that's there, and a tiny bit of blood can seep around it. It's not adequate to keep the tissue alive, but it does have a little bit of bleeding into the tissue as it dies. So it's never completely white or totally bloodless. Now that's different than someone who blows out a blood vessel and blood just squirts into the tissue space. So these right here, even though we do see specks of hemorrhage and even a little bit of it, those are technically speaking anoxic or hypoxic infarctions. They are decreased or lack of blood flow. And they might occur because the blood vessels have atherosclerosis in them and they have regional narrowings, and then you develop a clot on the surface of it, and the clot occurs right there at that moment. And everything downstream from that now is deprived of blood flow. That would be a thrombotic event. Right? Thrombosis, thrombotic event, blood clot formation. We never use the term thrombosis, by the way, outside of pathology. If you cut yourself and eventually the bleeding stops, that's normal hemostasis. You form clots the way you want them to. That's not thrombosis. A thrombus is an abnormal clot. It's in the circulating blood. It's not formed there because you had injury or because you're bleeding. It just formed inside a fixed vascular system. So it's thrombotic at that point. I also said embolus can also do it. What is an embolus? Have you heard that term before? It can be frequently, it's a fragment of a clot. An embolus is something that's floating along, it's a solid something, and it's floating along or being propelled along in the vascular system, and if it is a chunk of blood clot that's moving along, eventually it's going to come to a point where vessels are too small for it to pass through, and then it's going to clog it up. So it's something that flew in there. An embolus can be air. An embolus could be bone chips. Embolus could be a piece of cloth, a thrombus, a piece of cloth, something like that. Now, one of the things that we see in elderly people in particular, not uncommon cause of this right here, is somebody who has an irregular heartbeat. I realize we haven't really talked about cardiac disease, but they have an irregular heartbeat, not something that will kill them, but the atria are sort of acting up a little bit. So the blood doesn't flow efficiently, and you know, from the lungs into the left atrium, into the left ventricle, out through the aorta. And if the blood is moving kind of slow through there, or it's kind of twittering, or sometimes clot will form on the wall of the left atrium. Little bits of it will occur on that, what will form there. And then if that fragments off, and it comes through the mitral valve and into the left ventricle, and it comes out through the aorta, here's a little piece of clot now that was originally stuck to the wall of the minor chamber in the left, on the left side of the heart. That clot is typically more dense than the blood itself. And so when the ventricle beats and it throws the clot out through the aortic valve, it's going to roll along the outside of the aorta, on the outer wall of the aorta, and it's going to take off up the first vessel that it comes to. And that's a brachiocephalic that goes straight up into my right arm and right up here. And so the most common kind of clot that we will typically see will be something that involves something that came up through the right brachiocephalic, often from a piece of clot that formed inside the heart, amazingly enough. And so if you have an occluded vessel here, say the middle cerebral artery here, what would the symptoms be? Which side of the body would be affected? It's going to be the left side, yeah. So you're going to have left-sided hemiparesis, anability paresis, meaning paralysis. You'll have left-sided issues with movement, maybe lack of movement. You'll have left-sided issues with sensory and that sort of thing. So you can have an ischemic infarct on the basis of clot formation at the site in the blood vessel, typically on an atheromatous plaque, or you can have blood clots that came out, that sort of came out of the heart and moved in through the vascular system and ended up there. Oops, wrong button. Now, hypertensive bleeds are blow-offs, and this occurs when we got enough blood pressure that eventually it explodes a blood vessel. The arachnoid, that subarachnoid hemorrhage, I told you the story of the young girl who kept her cool and drove her mom to the hospital even though mom was dead or going to die. That was due to high blood pressure that expanded some of the blood vessels in the circle of Willis, and eventually one of them just popped. Here we're taking a look at a very common site for hypertensive bleeds, and there are in this area of the brain right in here, the corpus striatum, there are little blood vessels that sort of penetrate that and move through there, and they're quite thin walled. And if we have very high blood pressure in somebody, you can end up exploding one of those, and then the blood pours and just basically gushes out into the cerebral tissue. That is a hemorrhagic infarct. That is where we got dead tissue, and it is actually due to overt bleeding right into the substance of the brain. Now, one of the interesting things that can happen in somebody with high blood pressure will be that we'll have little dropouts. We'll have little bits and pieces of the brain will drop out. You don't necessarily have to have this kind of change right here. Or during an episode of high blood pressure, the blood vessel ruptures. If you have long-standing high blood pressure, what do you think your little bitty vessels are going to do, the little arterioles? And blood pressures, they're really not designed to deal with. What do you think they might try to do to accommodate or, deal with this higher blood pressure? Well, that's not too far from the truth, actually. If you've got a kind of a pounding pressure, what happens if you go home and you say, I'm going to work out tonight, and you start doing this, and you stay with it, okay, you got dumbbells, as opposed to doing what I call the 12-ounce curl, you know what I mean? You're actually doing something. What's going to happen to your muscle here? It's going to get bigger, and is that hypertrophy or hyperplasia? Have you heard those terms? Hypertrophy. Okay, the muscle cells get bigger. In the case of the blood vessels, if they're being beat up, they're going to do the same thing. They're going to try to increase the muscle around the wall. Now, in that case, the muscle cells don't get more muscle tissue. You actually have the capacity to reproduce. And so we'll see hyperplasia. We'll see increased smooth muscle around these arterioles because they're just getting their brains beat up. Well, if you got more and more muscle around it, eventually, just because of the mass effect of that muscle, the increased muscle is sort of adaptive change. The movement gets smaller. You don't have to necessarily have a focal lesion. You don't have to have a spot like an atherosclerotic plaque. Here I'm talking about arterioles, microscopic vessels, arteriole, I-O-L-E. And they will do just that. They will get thicker walled and thicker walled, and as they become thicker walled, the lumen becomes narrower and narrower. And so it's not uncommon in someone who's had long-standing hypertension to see all kinds of little holes out here simply because eventually the blood vessels become so thick walled that there is decreased blood flow because the lumen is so narrowed. So the blood pressure problem in the brain is two-edged. I mean, the two things are going to happen with high blood pressure. One, you've got the risk of an immediate blowout and a bleed straight into the tissue. These are almost uniformly fatal. It's very serious. The other will be if you have chronic ischemia throughout the brain because of high blood pressure in which you don't have a blowout, but you have this reactive process, this thing going on in the small blood vessels where they try to deal with this long-standing high blood pressure, and they became thicker and thicker and thicker and thick walled, eventually reducing the lumen size. So hypertensive changes in the brain really take two forms. One would be overt bleeds. Other would be areas of actual infarction because of decreased blood flow later on, years down the road. Now, we're not talking about something that occurs over a period of a few months. We're talking about high blood pressure. These adaptive changes take a long time to happen. Other hypertensive changes can lead to actual little aneurysms and eventually blow out of blood vessels. And this is what that woman had who didn't survive from that subarachnoid hemorrhage. This is a circle of Willis, and this is where we will see subarachnoid hemorrhages on the basis of high blood pressure. Occasionally, people have these developmentally. Occasionally, we'll see a bleed like this in a child, and it won't make any sense. And there was something wrong with the way in which those vessels formed. Sometimes it's what's called an arteriovenous malformation up in the substance of the brain, and sometimes you just have a congenitally weak area in one of the vessels that led to a little pooch out. And this is known as a berry aneurysm because it looks like a little raspberry. And this is showing where the common sites are. And these are, again, in people, adults, they're almost always due to blood pressure. And that eventually the high blood pressure just causes a little section to start a little pooch out there. And if it gets too big, it'll simply rupture, and then the blood will flow out into the subarachnoid space. On occasion, it may jet itself into the parenchyma of the brain and fool us and look like a vascular blowout in the substance of it. For example, here we see one that's sort of pooching into the area where the subarachnoid fluid is. This one might be pooched out into the substance of the brain itself. So when it blows, it shoots blood directly into the brain tissue. This is a berry aneurysm right here. You can see this is the circle of Willis. You know what I mean by the circle of Willis at the base of the brain, right? So even if you have decreased blood flow in one area, there's enough communication around that circle there. Has anybody been out here on kind of the southeast side of town with this, speaking of circles, this roundabout thing? God almighty, I have no idea what lane I'm supposed to be in. It's like a four-lane roundabout, and you crisscross. It's just a wonder. Every Saturday, I take the recycles down, I fill up the car with gas, I take the recycles down, and then I just pray I'm going to get around that thing without hitting anybody. All right. Well, at any rate, it's kind of a very peculiar circle down there. But here we can see this big pooched out kind of aneurysm, which is getting thinner and thinner as it stretches like a balloon. When you blow that balloon up, the wall gets thinner and thinner, and eventually you pop the balloon, and eventually this thing will pop. So that's one of the problems we see here. And that is the same picture again, showing a subarachnoid hemorrhage on the basis of high blood pressure. Yeah.
Is there any wide scale test going on?
Unfortunately, no. One of the things that we do, sometimes it will pinch on the optic. If it does hit the optic chiasm or something like that, there are a few little things that someone's got to be really clever at picking up. You might know it, because if you do know it's there, we can actually go in. What we do is we go in with a catheter up through the vascular system and basically spray a bunch of iron filings into that thing, and you'll cause it to clot. And once it will clot solid, hopefully you don't clot off part of the vessel, it will then sort of scar down and disappear. clearly that's almost an impossible surgical approach because of the base of the brain. You know, what are you going to do? You know, how are you going to get to it? There is a very minor familial tendency to this, and if you had somebody who had one, you might, I guess, look at other people in that kindred. But the fact is, no, that when we learn about it is when they blow. Yeah. The main thing is that most of them are hypertensive related, and so we want to keep people's blood pressure under control. Same thing, you'll see plenty of changes in the eyes. You'll get real good at recognizing all that vascular damage in the retina. And what you want to do is obviously prevent that. This is just one thing. When you see somebody with that, you know, that's probably the more important thing. Is you'll be the docs who will be seeing that. You'll be seeing all that vascular injury due to high blood pressure. You might think, God, I wonder what's going on at Circle of Willis. Maybe he needs to go see somebody else for that. Okay. This is what I was talking about before, and that is this very peculiar event that can occur years down the road. You see right here, this is a much larger area in the so-called corpus striatum. And what we're looking at are these little lacunar infarcts, these little holes in the head. And this was due to the fact that over the years of high blood pressure, the blood vessels became thicker and thicker wall trying to accommodate or deal with this non-physiologic high blood pressure. And eventually become thick-walled enough that areas that require kind of collateral circulation. You see, there's a blood vessel running here, there's a blood vessel running here, there's one running right there. And this area and that area required that there was collateral circulation between those two blood vessels. See, these guys are here, you've got to have overlap. Well, if these major vessels become so thick-walled that there's very little blood flow, there sure isn't going to be very much in that watershed, in that overflow, in the area that requires two of them to be healthy, so you've got sort of capillary network together that's being fed by two. So if both of those are now thickened, which they will be because of high blood pressure, that area right there that required good flow from both sides, because it's in the watershed area, it's in the middle, well, it's going to die, and that's exactly what happens. And so here's a peculiar sort of thing where you literally have holes in the head because of long-term uncorrected high blood pressure. You understand what I mean about needing to have the two blood vessels side by side have to be pretty good, they're separated, and you got that region of the brain is requiring blood flow from both sides in order for it to get enough. It doesn't have its own blood vessel, in other words. You got to have enough sort of collateral. Yeah.
So it's not
getting
blood from the muscle and blood from the nerves?
That's exactly right. And it's not a matter of atherosclerosis, although I will definitely say people with high blood pressure have much worse atherosclerosis coming early than it's worse. So I mean, in that case, it's just a matter of the vessels here, each of which sent capillary bed left and right to feed that area. As it became thicker and thicker and the blood flow reduced, the blood pressure reduces because of thick wall, now the area in the middle is going to be screwed. Chronic ischemic, this would be a situation, again, where it could be high blood pressure over the years, or a combination of high blood pressure and atherosclerosis, leading to poor circulation. And these folks are almost indistinguishable, say, from Alzheimer's disease. Exactly the same kind of problems, which you've had in both of them over the long period of years. You've got accelerated loss of neurons, and it's everywhere. And maybe it's most evident in cognitive, with cognitive function, but you've got decreased neurons, numbers of neurons every place because of poor blood flow over a long haul. Well, in case of Alzheimer's and so forth, the cells are dying because of accumulation of some protein internally. In this case, they were dying because of poor cerebral vascular flow. And so here's something which is chronic ischemia. It's not a stroke. It's not an occlusive event where one region of the brain is involved. It's over the whole thing. And typically, again, that's high blood pressure and atherosclerosis together, leading to early loss of neurons all over the place. Okay, infections. Infections of the brain. What we're really going to spend a good bit of time talking about will be the meninges. So we will make the distinction here. I'll make the distinction between infections in the brain itself and the meninges. When we take a look basically at the kinds of things that can cause infections of the central nervous system. It runs the complete gamut from everything from prions, which have no nucleic acids, you know, they're just an infectious protein, acute spongiform encephalopathy, one in cattle, one in us. There's one in elk, there's one in squirrels in our area, by the way. Parasites, viruses, bacteria, the whole shooting match. So potentially every kind of infectious organism can cause infection of the brain or the meninges. Now, this is an infection of the meninges, actually infection in the cerebral spinal fluid itself, bacterial meningitis. And this has changed very dramatically over the last 20 years or so. This is a condition that we used to see in children with more regularity, and thank God we don't see it anymore. And it's diminished because of the successful immunization programs, particularly for Haemophilus influenza. But in this case, you can see this is a drawing where we typically see, you can see this kind of yellow creamy exudate over the surface of the brain. And what we see in the cerebral spinal fluid, typically the bacteria get there. There are really two or three ways in which the bacteria can get into the cerebral spinal fluid. And when you think about it, it's just a perfect media for them to grow in. It's a watery medium. It's got sugars in it. It's got electrolytes in it. It's got all kinds of stuff. It would be absolutely the perfect growth medium for them. Most of the time, they get there by means of the vascular system. And the bugs that we see that are going to do that are ones that tend to invade the vessel wall. And then they can rupture the blood vessel or get through the vessel and into the cerebral spinal fluid. Other ways would be, say, from an infection close by that can spread directly, say from a sinus or something like that. And then obviously something which is a direct implant in case of penetrating wounds or something like that might lead to it. Most of the times, the bacteria, and they are, at least the ones that are extremely symptomatic and are going to lead to long-term sequelae, long-term problems, are bacterial. We can certainly have viral infections. And the viruses that infect the lining cells of the subarachnoid space. And they can lead to scarring, and they can lead to long-term problems, such as epilepsy. But most people who develop a viral meningitis tend to get over it. People who have developed bacterial meningitis all will die with it, without treatment. That is to say, if we don't get them on antibiotics quickly. And so the long-term problems, particularly of bacterial, could be any kind of meningitis, will be scarring of the meninges, scarring to the surface of the brain, which typically then can become a focus of epileptic activity, electrical activity that spreads to create a seizure. We could have abscesses. Another thing would be if we have scarring at the base of the brain. Remember, we talked about that in the context of flow of cerebral spinal fluid. And that then may lead to an adult form or an acquired form of hydrocephalus.
Yeah. With use of antibiotics, why does bacterial meningitis seem to be worse?
With antibiotics, it's not. It actually, if we get to it quickly, and they can't dilly-dally. If you come to that late, you may be able to sterilize the person, but you've already got scar formation and all these other sorts of things at the beginning. But untreated bacterial meningitis is basically 100% mortality rate.
And then what keeps just a regular old virus or whatever you're sick from getting into the brain?
In most cases, they either don't have the specific receptor, there's not something there for them to bind to. Most viruses, not all, but most viruses have fairly specific cell they're going to infect and something they're going to bind to. There are those that do not, like cytomegalic inclusion virus, and it certainly can cause infection of the brain or infection of the meninges. The blood-brain barrier is extremely efficient at keeping out all kinds of stuff, and that works, but that doesn't apply to the cerebral spinal fluid. That only applies to the vascular interchange in the substance of the brain itself. In years past, everybody died with this kind of thing. We had a lot of mortality from this. I remember hearing a talk one time from somebody within the 90s at that time, and this was back in the 80s, and he said when he was in grade school, he made it a point never to get to really close to any of his compatriots in school. He didn't make friends because he had no idea who was coming back tomorrow, who wasn't. and death from infectious disease in years past, meningitis in particular, but other sorts of things, was extremely common. Today, the serious ones, the bacterial thing, again, we can immunize against the so-called encapsulated strains, pneumococcus and Haemophilus, and then you basically don't get it. But viral meningitis, we still see. West Nile, for example, can cause both meningitis and infection of the brain. This right here is just infection of the meninges. It may spread, it may come from the cerebral spinal fluid and meninges into the cerebral. Well, at any rate, this is looking at fairly typical bacterial meningitis. This might be something. Here is one where the exudates are all at the base of the brain, and that's one that we often would associate with TB meningitis, for whatever reason it tends to accumulate there. So any kind of bacteria can, if it can get into the cerebral spinal fluid, any kind of bacteria is going to cause that, it can cause meningitis. Go back just for a minute here. I want to say just a couple words about some of the changes that we see. When we do a spinal tap and we're taking a look to see if we have bacteria and so forth in the cerebral spinal fluid, we actually take a sample for culture. But we also take a look at the quantity of stuff that's in there. And we will look at the cell count. Normally, you don't have any inflammatory cells at all in the cerebral spinal fluid. There's no reason for them. They're simply not there. So if we see a high cell count in the cerebral spinal fluid, which means basically you see any at all, it means something's there that doesn't belong. And this is a response. If it's bacteria, what kind of inflammatory cell do you think you would see in abundance? Exactly, PNN. If it's a viral infection, which would you think we would see in abundance? Lymphocytes. You'd see more lymphocytes. If it's a bacterial infection, and normally the glucose in the cerebral spinal fluid is about two-thirds of your blood glucose. It's not exactly the same, it's about two-thirds. If you had bacteria in there, what do you think the glucose level would do in the cerebral spinal fluid? You think they would metabolize it and use it? Yeah, and so the glucose level drops quite a bit in the case of bacterial meningitis. Obviously, if we've got a bacterial meningitis, many times we'll do a grand stain to see the bug and culture it, of course. But what the doctor's got to do is initiate therapy immediately based on best guess on what's the patient's age, or what are we most likely going to see in this age group, where did it possibly come from? Is it something that came from, say, an affected sinus, which would be different than something that might have come from the bloodstream? And so for that first 24 to 48 hours, you're really flying blind. You have to start an antibiotic based on what they think is the most likely organism. And sometimes we get it wrong. Okay, now I mentioned that you can have extension of the infection into the brain substance, but sometimes, and this is what we're looking at here, the abscesses of the brain. And here would be an example maybe of something that's coming from the bulb or part of the meninges. But here we're taking a look at an old cerebral abscess. And most of the times when we see this, it's something that occurred just because you had bacteria in the bloodstream, maybe coming from a damaged valve or just having bacteria in the bloodstream. And you might think, not my bloodstream, Buster. I don't have bacteria in my bloodstream. I got clean blood. Do you think you ever have bacteria in your bloodstream? Brush your teeth this morning, you'd be amazed. Brush your teeth and do a blood culture, you would be shocked to see what's in your blood. Just from brushing your teeth, you shower bacteria in your bloodstream every time you do that. But the bacteria are removed either in the spleen or the liver by the macrophages, they gobble them up, and it never causes any problem. Every now and then, though, a person, particularly people who have really rotten dental care, may have a lot of bacteria in the bloodstream coming in any given day at any given time, and they can develop abscess. An abscess, typically the bacteria gets there by means of the bloodstream. And so we do have, and occasionally we'll see this in someone who's otherwise perfectly healthy, and that happened to somebody I know, a faculty member, his wife, began to act kind of strange one day, and eventually she got around and thought she was having a stroke, although she really wasn't in the age group for that. And eventually they got a CAT scan, she had a hole in her head, and she had a cerebral abscess. and surgically go in and drain it, eventually remove all the crud. And it caused a fair bit of damage, and she was a much different person afterwards. It was kind of in a frontal area. And actually, she was a much more interesting person, I thought, afterwards. But anyway, not the way you show it, not the way you become the life of the party, I will tell you. Now I think about it, I don't know if I went a little bit or anything with it, but anyway. And she had good dentition. She didn't have rotten teeth or anything. She had no valvular disease in the heart, anything we would associate with that. It just happened. So in this case, we're talking about actual infection in the brain, and it's localized. It's bacterial, as opposed to some viral infection that may be diffuse, like herpes, relatively spread around, like herpes, or cytomegalic inclusion virus, or West Nile, which would be throughout the brain, or HIV, which would be throughout the brain, as opposed to a localized thing. So that's a bacterial kind of thing. Here's an example of relatively localized. This is herpes, viral encephalitis, and for whatever reason, I have absolutely no idea why, the temporal lobe is completely missing here. And for whatever reason, herpes likes to go there. Normally, you all have, I guarantee you right now, almost everybody has herpes, oral herpes, you got it from your parents. Herpes hominis type 1. I'm not talking about genital herpes, and I'm not going to go there. But anyway, almost everybody carries herpes, and as you might know, herpes and chickenpox virus live in neurons. I mean, they can stay in the neurons and be completely quiescent there. And in this case, it becomes active. So when we see this, almost always it's somebody who's immunosuppressed, either because of cancer, chemotherapy, or HIV, or something like that. To see this extensive destruction in the brain due to herpes would be almost unthinkable in someone who has a healthy immune system. So even though most of you have herpes, you don't have oral herpes in any rate, you're not going to have issues with this. Now, I mentioned HIV. HIV does not infect the brain substance. It doesn't infect the neurons. Remember, HIV has to have a CD4 cell for it to bind to. Maybe you're not remembering that because we haven't talked about it yet, but you know the story fundamentally, right? Virus binds to the CD4 receptor, and then it gets internalized into the T4 lymphocyte. It has to have a protein that allows it to bind the CCR gene, and then a CCR protein on the surface. So one's a binding site, the other is where it actually injects its RNA in there. Well, as it turns out, we do have T4-bearing cells in the central nervous system. Our neurons are not, but we have our own the police force. There is actually an inflammatory, there are inflammatory cells natively in the central nervous system that come from macrophages. Macrophages that go into the central nervous system and they stay there the rest of their lives. And those are called microglia. And those microglial cells are kind of wandering around. I don't know, they're looking for trash or junk or bacteria. I don't know what they're looking for, but anyway, they're essentially the police force inside the central nervous system. They do have T4 receptors. And what will happen with HIV is HIV will infect those cells. It can infect the neurons, but it will infect the microglial cells. And then it causes the mic eventually, as you know, it proliferates to the point where the cell will die. Well, one of the things that happens then is that there's a release of the proteins from the HIV virus, from the AIDS virus itself, in that local area because they're busy, obviously, proliferating inside the microglial cell. And the GP120 protein is fairly toxic to neurons, probably through nitric oxide as an intermediary. But what happens there is that the microglia get infected. They produce lots of viruses, and there's a lot of mismatch between the amount of protein we need and making the virus, so there's a lot of release of viral proteins into the area around there, and that then causes the toxic effect of that alone causes the death of the neurons. People who we see are being very successfully treated with multiple drug therapy with HIV, we don't know what's going to happen down the road. It used to be everybody who survived about 10, 12 years developed what's called HIV encephalopathy. And it looks like very rapidly advancing Alzheimer's or something of that sort, where neurons every place are dying. Cognitive, motor, sensory, everything is going over a period of about 6 months to 2 years. with HIV encephalopathy, and that's what it's due to, even though the neurons themselves are not infected, but it's a diffuse process throughout. We don't know what's going to happen down the road with people who are being successfully maintained with antivirals with the this multi-drug therapy called heart therapy, which has got these highly active retroviral therapy. We'll find out. Another infectious agent that will involve the central nervous system as well as the meninges is syphilis. God almighty, I know what you're saying. Will we ever shut up? I'm going to probably get through this and we're going to have to quit. My rule of thumb, by the way, on giving talks, just keep this in mind when you, you'll be doing this yourself, I guarantee. Maybe some of you are AIs, have been, or you're asked to give talks, to groups and so forth. As a general rule, I never talk for any longer. It's 1 minute for the age of my audience. So if you're talking to second graders or something, talk for about 8 minutes. And then you do something. And here, I'm assuming that most of you, the average age here is in the early 20s, mid-20s, so I'm going to do for about 20 minutes, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to tell you a witty story, maybe I'll sing a song, I don't know. But anyway, here's an infectious disease. That was our break, by the way, that was our 20 minutes. Tertiary syphilis involves the central nervous system in an interesting way. As you may or may not know, the target organ for the trepanning pallidum, the causative organism of syphilis, is the small blood vessel. It is not really the neuron. It's not the aorta. It's the smallest of small arteries. It's the arterioles. And what it does is it invades those. It proliferates there. It causes an immune reaction where the immune system essentially destroys those tiny arteries. Well, if that's occurring diffusely throughout the brain or in regions of the spinal cord, you can imagine that there's going to be overall general central nervous system involvement. And in this case, it's kind of vascular. Occasionally, we do actually see kind of like an abscess of sorts, kind of a granuloma of sorts, composed of direct infection of the central nervous system. But most times, it's an overall generalized change. And it's really vascular in nature because the syphilitic organism causes the destruction of the small blood vessels. When it involves this part of the spinal cord, they develop a walking pattern called tabes dorsalis, where they sort of slap their feet down because they couldn't do this. If I asked you to ask someone with syphilis, close their eyes, go from the finger to the nose, they can't do it because they don't know where their parts are in space. They don't have this proprioception. And these where those tracks run, they're among the longest tracks in the central nervous system. So they're the most vulnerable to vascular, diffuse vascular injury. We may come back to this when we come back then on Thursday. This was the cause why we have custodial care mental hospitals in every state in the union. It was what's called general paralysis of the insane, tertiary syphilis. People would abandon family members. This was back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. They would abandon family members downtown because they couldn't put up with them anymore. They were nuts. Some of them were paralyzed. General paralysis, the insane was tertiary syphilis. And the state couldn't really have a lot of people sort of hanging out on the street corners and basically waiting to die. And so we developed a system of custodial care mental health hospitals where people who were indigent went. All right, we're going to pick that back up on Thursday then, so I will see you then. Thank you all. You probably noticed that, let me just say you